B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, June 27th, 2017. Mitch McConnell has blinked. He doesn't have the votes to pass the dismantling of Obamacare in the Senate. We'll update you on that. The story just broke moments before I sat down behind the microphone. But I want to begin with a second look at yesterday's surprising Supreme Court action related to the royal decree, the travel ban issued by Donald Trump. And to be clear, we're talking about the cleaned up, the scrubbed second version. The first one was withdrawn by Trump, apparently under some duress. But there's an interesting analysis that kind of eases some of my concerns that I expressed yesterday when this surprise ruling was announced. And I had thought that the court might take the case, but I didn't expect them to take any action to issue the ruling that allows parts of the travel ban to go forward. But I've linked to a very strong analysis by Professor Corey Brettschneider. He teaches at Brown University, and in full disclosure, my stepson went to Brown, and I do have a favorable, if somewhat rosy, impression of that institution of higher learning in Providence, Rhode Island. That aside, the headline of his commentary reads, "Your travel ban isn't safe yet, Mr. Trump." He says, read carefully, the opinion makes it clear that most of the Supreme Court justices think Trump's executive order is likely to be struck down if the court hears the case in the fall. Now, as I mentioned, by fall, the issue should be moot because both the 120-day refugee ban and the 90-day travel ban aimed at the six Muslim-majority countries will have expired. Now, it is possible that Trump could try to extend them. My thinking was that if he could get these things to pass muster, that he would find excuses to keep extending them. Well, we're still working on the heavy vetting. I wanted to say petting there. Kind of extreme and hysterical measures that he claims we need to take for people who seek to enter our country from these specific nations. So Brettschneider continues, for the past 6 months, Trump's ban has been on hold, battered repeatedly in a series of lawsuits. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the ban likely violates the Constitution's prohibition on favoring or disfavoring certain religions, while the Ninth Circuit held that the ban likely violates an immigration law that prohibits discriminating on the basis of nationality. Both of those courts ruled that the ban should be suspended in its entirety. And what the court did, while it gave a minor victory to Trump, pending a full review in the fall, it left part of the ban in place, but only for people outside the United States who lack a relationship inside the country. So that narrows the focus, and it does give relief to many of the people who had been issued visas and traveled to the United States at the end of January, only to discover that the drawbridge had been lifted and the moat had been filled with fresh alligators here in Fortress America. So the analysis here continues. The court made it clear that the Fourth and Ninth Circuits were correct to suspend the ban for those nationals who have bona fide relationships here in the country. In drawing that line, the Supreme Court handed a major victory to the plaintiffs who brought these cases, people with families, the Hawaii Attorney General who sued in part on behalf of the state's universities and its students. But he continues, the real blow to the administration is hiding between the lines. Already, the court's logic suggests that it is strongly leaning toward striking down much of the ban when, and I'll say if, it hears oral arguments this October. To enjoin an executive order, as the Fourth and Ninth Circuits did, a court must be convinced that the policy has, quote, substantial likelihood, end quote, of being illegal. By keeping some of the injunctions against the travel ban in place pending the oral arguments, the Supreme Court was indicating that it agreed with the lower courts. Now, this is not how I interpreted it yesterday, so I'm glad to have somebody smarter than me who offers this point of view, which is certainly less irritating. He went on, the justices would not have kept the lower court's injunctions against the ban at all unless they agreed that the ban, at least in part, was likely to be found illegal. So I find this somewhat comforting, because the 9-0 unsigned opinion that was released yesterday, I found very troubling. And I regard this as an activist court, an activist judiciary. And that is the label that is often flung from the right at liberal judges who, find constitutional rights and rule on them from the bench. And I believe that this is activist because the court adopted language that, to my knowledge, is not currently part of a law. This language that you must be able to prove that you have a bona fide relationship. And the court didn't offer a formal definition, but it offered some examples. And this bona fide relationship includes a family connection, a business relationship, or educational. For example, you've been accepted at Harvard and you're from Pakistan. So, let me use one of the countries where the ban is in effect. You're from Syria. But by not offering a definition, by not citing a definition that occurs somewhere else in federal law about what bona fide relationship means, they actually made Clarence Thomas seem wise, because he warned in his partial dissent that this standard is unworkable and could prod a wave of lawsuits. And I am loath to agree with Clarence Thomas about anything, but I think he got that one right. He did fail to call his colleagues activists, and I think he would have been within his rights to do so. Meanwhile, a judge has ruled that more than 1,400 Iraqi nationals, most of whom are Chaldean Christians, are being protected from deportation for the next 14 days. Judge Mark Goldsmith temporarily halted deportations while he considers a class action lawsuit representing 114 Iraqis who were arrested in the Detroit area earlier in June. Attorneys say these people, most of whom are a part of the Chaldean minority, could face persecution or death if they're returned to their country of birth. And Goldsmith said that such harm far outweighs any interest the government may have in proceeding with the removals immediately. Wow. Nice to see somebody in the chain of command here has a little compassion and a sense that these lives are really at risk. This is not some theoretical threat. And we have so many people who are willing to just dismiss claims of realistic claims of asylum and just push these people out and say, not my problem. It's astounding. In Texas, the tough new sanctuary city law passed by the state legislature, signed by Governor Abbott, and it bans local communities from claiming status as sanctuary city and refusing to collaborate with immigration and customs enforcement. The small border city of El Cenizo is the plaintiff before U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia, trying to halt this law before it takes effect on September 1st. The claim from Abbott and the Republicans is that this improves public safety because people will be deported, and they presume that anybody who's undocumented has criminal intentions or actual criminal activities. But, of course, the flip side is true, that public safety is affected when communities can't collaborate with the police on ordinary criminal, prevention or prosecution, investigation. And the case that the kind of crime that people are quite concerned about is domestic violence, where victims will not be willing to come forward and name their abusers because that person might end up being deported. And I believe that sanctuary cities are a reasonable local reaction to the hysterical overreach of federal authorities under Trump. We'll see how this proceeds in the great state of Texas. Now to the healthcare debate. Just as I got ready to sit down behind the microphone today, I got a flash alert on my computer that Mitch McConnell has discovered that he doesn't have the votes. The Republican caucus of 52 members in the U.S. Senate is deeply divided, and it appears to be getting worse. So McConnell has pulled the plan to conduct a vote to end, to begin debate on the measure, because he didn't have enough votes to even get that parliamentary action taken care of. And Susan Collins of Maine, a pivotal figure who's on the mild, not mean side of the Republican divide, she said, "I don't see how any tinkering is going to satisfy my concerns about the massive cuts to Medicaid that will harm people in my state of Maine." And on the other side, you've got Rand Paul and Ron Johnson, senators who are very hardliners, who don't care what the impact is. They don't care how many people lose insurance, get sick, or die. They are determined to repeal Obamacare. Just doesn't matter to them what the consequences are. And so that split, along with Dean Heller of Nevada, who was an early announced opponent of the package as it now stands. And then you've got John Kasich, the guy from Ohio, governor there, who ran for president last year, and he is seen as a reasonable Republican. He accepted the Medicare expansion in Ohio, and he is fighting to keep it. And he is leaning on Rob Portman, the U.S. senator from Cincinnati, who I have family members who are friends of his, and he is clearly on the hot seat, because McConnell was calling him out at a Republican lunch today, and apparently his governor, John Kasich, is calling him out just as often. Kasich said, "Who would lose this coverage? The mentally ill, the drug addicted, the chronically ill. I believe these are the people who need to have coverage." Wow. I mean, that is so simplistic. It is so frickin' obvious. But most of the Republicans can dance around it and say, "Oh, you know, Obamacare doesn't work. Premiums are going up. We got to lower premiums." Well, the way the Republicans are going to lower premiums is by watering down the coverage. You're going to get shitty insurance with a huge deductible, and maybe your premium will be a little lower, but will you actually be able to use your insurance? Many people, for example, who earn less than $50,000 a year might decide to forego a vacation or something else in order to pay for health insurance. But if you end up with a $10,000 deductible, you're not going to be able to get to the point where the insurance kicks in. And so this is a package of death. And it's all about greed. The Republicans know that in this reverse Robin Hood move, that they are ignoring the needs of many Americans, particularly middle and low income Americans, and they are deciding that their lives are not as important as delivering tax cuts for the ultra wealthy who fund the Republican Party. So I had planned to go into more detail, but since the vote has been delayed, we'll just postpone that, because the bill is likely to change before it could be brought up for a vote. And chances are it will be changed not for the better, but for the worse. Now, one of the other things that is now amusing is that the Washington Post reported earlier today, before McConnell postponed the vote, that over in the House of Representatives, Speaker Paul Ryan had notified his colleagues to hang around till the end of this week, because he thought Mitch was going to pull off a legislative miracle and deliver the Senate bill to the House to be rammed through and rubber stamped before we eat too many hot dogs and drink too many beers over this extended forthcoming July 4th holiday week. Yeah, it's going to go on and on, because the 4th falls on a Tuesday. And the promise of making the coverage more affordable, well, we know that that is simply a lie, as I fleshed out for you a moment ago. Well, here's great news. Elizabeth Warren has finally supported Bernie Sanders. Not for president. No, she couldn't bring herself to do that last year. But she is backing Bernie on single-payer health care and calling on the Democratic Party to run on single-payer. Not just, her personal support for it, But she said it's time for the next step. The next step is single payer. She said Obama had tried to move us forward with health care coverage by using a conservative model that came from one of the conservative think tanks that had been advanced by a Republican governor in Massachusetts, she said, without naming Mitt Romney. So this is an important shift. And it gives Bernie Sanders some support from the left wing of the Democratic Party. And I want to note that here in California, we saw a bill for single-payer health care pass through the state Senate, but it has not been submitted to the California Assembly. And on Friday, the speaker there, Anthony Rendon, pulled the measure, at least for now. It is on a two-year cycle, so it could be brought up, revived, at any time over the next 18 months. And I actually support the move by the speaker. Now, David Sirota wrote a powerful piece at the International Business Times yesterday, and he correctly cited the political influence from donors from Big Pharma to the medical establishment who do influence the supermajority-controlled House, Democratic-controlled, here in California. And I'm sure that that's some influence. The other influence comes from the incredible effort of the California Nurses Association. Their national affiliate is National Nurses United, and they have been a driving force along with Bernie Sanders. Now, people outside the state are taking pot shots at Rendon, at Governor Brown, and others. But the truth is, and I am a staunch supporter of single payer, we had SB2 vetoed twice by Arnold Schwarzenegger about 10 years ago, and I was quite opposed to Schwarzenegger's moves on that. But this package is not complete. We don't have a funding mechanism. We don't have even the glimmer of approval of waivers from the federal government to convert the subsidies that might come under the bill that's now stalled in the Senate to give states flexibility to use Medicaid money as they see fit. But at this point, the $400 billion per year cost of single payer in California is not nearly funded. I mean, Jerry Brown's bullet train has a higher percentage of funding committed than single payer does. And let me give you a cautionary note that in April of this year, responding to the complaints of many Californians like me, Brown and the Democratic-controlled legislature rammed through an increase in the gas tax, in car registration fees, and a few other tweaks to raise about $6 billion a year to repair the crumbling roads in California. I fully support it. But the polls show that even many Democrats are not willing to pay more money at the pump or when they register their cars in order to fix the roads here. And the Republicans are bitterly opposed to it, and they are going to be using that as a wedge issue in next year's campaigns. You pile a huge unfunded liability like single payer, and the Democrats will lose control of California. And most people think that, gosh, you know, California, because for president and for senator and all of our statewide officials are Democrats, they assume that it's a solid blue state. But you get 20, 25 miles in from the coast, and you're in Trump territory. And I think most people don't recognize that, particularly those of you who only know about California from TV and other media. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Benny Alto, who's got a subscription for each one of his dogs, Patrick Garay, Andrew Harnack, and Susan Lundgren. I'm grateful to each of you for your support. I'd like to see more people sign up. I've lost a few subscribers recently, and you can do it in just a couple of minutes. Click on over to peterbcollins.com, click on menu, pull it down, click on become a subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page where you are confronted with an array of choices, and you can find the one that fits your budget and your commitment to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. So do it today. I have copies of Listen Liberal, Thomas Frank's latest book. I'd love to send you a new one if you take out an annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S. So yesterday, late in the day, Sean Spicer warned that Syria is preparing for what looks like another chemical weapons attack. Now, I'm working from an article in the New York Times because the idea that Syria is responsible for the chemical incident that occurred on April 4th in Khan Shukun is still a very open question. And the recent reporting of Seymour Hersh on this casts even more doubt on the official White House story. But this warning from the White House is even stranger. Because over at the Pentagon and the State Department, they're saying, what you talking about? For example, an official with the U.S. Central Command, which oversees combat operations in the Middle East, said, quote, he has no idea what the White House statement was referring to. Now, the Russians and the Syrians bitterly denounced this, as they did the last incident, which may have been a frame-up. I lean toward that conclusion. But once again, Trump seems to be tweeting before he gets his facts straight and tweeting before he gets his whole team aligned around a particular development or a particular threat. And by drawing a red line, as Obama was accused of doing, he sets himself up for being forced to take actions that may be based on faulty premises. And after meeting with India's Prime Minister Modi, we're told by The Guardian that Trump is pondering a crackdown on Pakistan. Now, the dispute between India and Pakistan goes back decades. They both have nuclear weapons. They have deep hate and resentment for each other. And so this is like when Trump went to Saudi Arabia, they whispered in his ear, Qatar is the problem, Qatar is the problem. Trump just takes that at face value and he gets played. And now we're in the middle of this Donnybrook between Qatar and the Saudis and the UAE and Bahrain and Egypt that could compromise the military bases that we have in Bahrain and in Qatar, could lead to a Saudi invasion of Qatar. Could be the basis for a new assault on Iran. And Trump, who claims he's so smart and he's got that great brain, this is a guy who doesn't listen to the experts. He knows better. Now, Trump is gloating today because he caught CNN in a fake news moment. You may have heard about this. Last week, an article was posted on the CNN website accusing a friend of Trump's named Anthony Scaramucci of being involved in a Russian investment fund. CNN has retracted the story and forced three journalists to resign yesterday, including Eric Lichtblau, who is a very talented investigative reporter who was just hired from the New York Times a couple of months ago. He joined Lex Harris and Thomas Frank. Let me hasten to add, this is not my friend Tom Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas and Listen Liberal, but another guy who happens to be named Thomas Frank. And my friend Tom Frank was on Twitter and Facebook this morning denying that he's been fired from CNN or that he ever worked there. And I said, oh yeah, sure. Glenn Greenwald has a good analysis about the CNN egg on its face. And also, he recaps some of the fake news, the unproven, evidence-free stories that have been reported mostly about Russia in the last few months. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast, and it's worth your time to read it. Now, James O'Keefe, the video trickster who came out of Breitbart, the Breitbart wing of the Republican Party, he's released another trick video. This one, so far, we don't know all the details and how it was edited and all that, but he has a CNN producer who doesn't work on mainstream news. He is a health producer named John Bonifield. And Bonifield is heard on these videotapes saying that CNN dedicated airtime to the Russia investigations for ratings, but that he personally ultimately believes the story is mostly bullshit right now. Now, this pains me because I agree with his comment, but it's tainted because it's been processed through Jimmy O'Keefe. He's the guy who illegally broke into the phone room of former Senator Mary Landrieu in New Orleans a few years ago and got caught. But this producer goes on, "We don't have any big giant proof. I just feel like they don't really have it, but they want to keep digging. And so the president is probably right to say, look, you're witch hunting me. You have no smoking gun, no real proof." And there's a quote here of Jeff Zucker, the CEO of CNN now. After a news meeting about the announcement by Trump that we're pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, Zucker said, "We're done with that. Let's get back to Russia." And it's fair to say that Russia has boosted the ratings of CNN and, in particular, Rachel Maddow at MSDNC. This whole thing is starting to crumble. And Trump is kind of on the upsurge. His echo chambers are pushing the message that collusion hasn't been proven, and therefore Trump is going to turn this around, and it will be the Democrats who get exposed for generating a false narrative. That could be true. Remember, just yesterday I cited Norman Solomon's warning to that effect. Last year at this time, Brazil was busy impeaching its first female president, Dilma Rousseff. Today, the man who engineered her exit and then replaced her, the current president, Michel Temer, has been formally accused of corruption. And this is not just about the car wash investigation related to the state oil company Petrobras. This allegedly is a bribe that was offered between March and April, a measly $150,000 from a former chairman of a meatpacking company. So Temer, of course, denies it. He says he's going to hang on. The case goes to the lower chamber of deputies in Congress, which has to decide by a two-thirds vote if the charges have merit. And a couple of quick ones as we wrap up today. Last week, Google announced that it is no longer scanning your Gmail, or mine, to look for clues about what kind of ads to service. And I appreciate that, Google. But over in Europe, the European Union has announced a $2 billion-plus fine on Google for abusing its dominance of the search engine market. And the allegation is that Google rigged the search results to benefit its Frugal service and other online shopping activities that it profited from at the expense of competitors. Google has 90 days to stop its illegal activities, explain how it will reform its ways, or face fines of up to 10.6 million euros a day, which is about 5% of the estimated average daily profit of the parent company Alphabet. This follows a seven-year probe into Google search in Europe. This is a shocking development. The production of coal, you know, clean coal, in the United States has jumped by 19% in the first 5 months of this year. Not only that, China and India have also boosted their coal production. The worldwide increase is about 6%, but that's 19% in the United States. Now, I don't know where the market is for this coal. We've been told that prices have collapsed, demand has collapsed. Is this all a Trump effect? We'll be digging without blowing up a mountaintop to try to get more answers for you. And finally today, The Guardian has pulled back the curtain on a guy named Jay Sekulow. He surfaced recently as a defender of Trump. A lot of people have never heard of this guy, but I have. He used to co-host a daily radio show that we aired on our radio station in Monterey, KRXA, co-hosted with Barry Lynn, who I have deep respect for. He is about to retire as the head of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. But because he ran a nonprofit, his radio show had to be balanced, and so he co-hosted with Jay Sekulow. Well, it turns out that Sekulow, the former lawyer for Pat Robertson, has built a nonprofit empire that has made him and his family members quite wealthy, and they live high on the hog or off the hog. I can never remember that. Anyway, he's got these nonprofits. He raises money with a Christian pitch. He's got a radio show. He's got the American Center for Law and Justice. He's got the Constitutional Litigation and Advocacy Group. And I want you to read this article because Sekulow himself has received more than $3 million in compensation, his wife more than $1 million, his brother got $9 million, his kids are they're on the radio show, it's on a station here, I listen to it every once in a while. The wife, Pam Sekulow, bought a condo from one of the nonprofits, and then the nonprofit forgave the loan and called it compensation. So they're playing all kinds of games that appear to be questionable, if not illegal, trying to catch up with the Clintons, maybe. But I find this quite revealing, and I hope you take a moment to read the expose from the Guardian of Britain today. Thanks for listening to my news and comment daily podcast. It's available free, and it's available on YouTube every day when I remember to post it there.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.